Good day, and welcome to the first Student Affairs podcast discussing the CAS standards of financial aid programs. If you are new to the podcast, my name is Logan Hermes, and I'm a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse studying Student Affairs Administration. At the beginning of my first semester back in September, I was given the choice to look into different functional area topics that encompassed an aspect of student affairs. Since a majority of my student affairs experience consisted of residence life and conferences, I wanted to know more about how money moved to and from universities. A couple of topics I chose centered around Veterans Affairs, financial aid programs, and admission work. I was given the financial aid programs piece, and this is where our subject begins. In this episode, we are going to look at the CAS standards for financial aid programs through multiple lenses. I've interviewed three full-time staff members and received responses from student affairs professionals all over the internet on what the first impression of financial aid programs is to them. Coincidentally, I have first-hand testimonials from students and articles to provide a unique insight into what financial aid means to not only faculty in the school, but also the surrounding populace. To begin, let's briefly go over what the CAS standards are and what does CAS even mean. CAS, C-A-S, stands for the Council of the Advancement of Standards in Higher Education. I know what you're thinking. Why don't they just call it cachet? And honestly, I have no idea. The Council has 45 different functional area standards for higher education programs and services. These standards give a look into how a program is assessed at an institution and how this service to the students is effective. The real question is, does the program do what it's supposed to do? CAS develops these self-assessment guides, which theoretically should help departments with the means for doing their own self-assessment for their own programs and services. This is a lot of information to absorb. But in short, CAS helps provide a set of guidelines for programs and individuals who work in departments that oversee one of the 45 functional student affairs areas and how to perform effectively in their field. CAS was established in 1979 and created because of debate on whether student affairs work was actually a profession. Even though that question is still up in the air for some, Laura Dean and Ginny Jones in the book, Advancing Higher Education as a Field of Study, in Quest of a Doctoral Degree, elaborate on the reason for CAS and how there are two elements that receive constant attention when having to describe student affairs as a professional practice. These elements are, 1. What the preparation of a student affairs professional is, and 2. The development of an agreed-upon standard of practice grounded in theory. Enter CAS, or cachet, if you will. Dean and Jones further explain how using the CAS approach in an institution can encourage cross-functional collaboration while also disseminating standards of practice in graduate preparation programs in the student affairs field. It is important to mention that CAS assumes that their standards are not to be seen as a perfect way to practice student affairs, but they should reflect upon good practice with a better understanding of the functional area. Are you asleep yet? To be honest, this is some dry material. So on my way to my first interview, I was very nervous. What I wanted to find out was coded in darkness, and I had no idea of how finances worked when it came to aid for students. So how could I keep up with one of these interviews? I formed my questions following a format along the lines of, what does financial aid mean? And what do you believe the impact of your position has on financial aid programs? Overall, if I could answer these questions, I believe I could give myself a better understanding of the field of financial aid. In the next segment, I will go into the interviews I performed, starting with the Director of Financial Aid, Robert Bode, at the University of Wisconsin River Falls. This interview will be gone through by myself, but unlike the interview, I will be able to pose questions to you, the listener. I started from a Director of Financial Aid and worked my way down and across this hierarchy. It's kind of like dusting shelves. You always have to start from the top. Welcome back! As discussed in the previous clip, I performed interviews with people in the financial aid field and a little outside the FAP field. These interviews serve as not only a learning opportunity, but also a great look into the different experiences and similarities one can expect from entering this field themselves. My first interviewee was Robert Bodie, the Director of Financial Aid at the University of Wisconsin-River Falls, and the main individual who oversees the Veteran Student Services Office. I managed to snag a meeting with him, and I am glad that I did. Robert has worked in the field of financial aid for over 25 years at various institutions around the country and provided great insight into how he views financial aid programs as a whole and with his own institution. We sat in his office on the third floor of North Hall. It was a very quiet atmosphere, and he was able to give me his full attention for the interview. We exchanged introductions. I stumbled through mine, trying to hastily explain who I was and why I was there, which I imagine is how most graduate students act. To begin, I asked Robert about the rewards and challenges he has faced while working with financial aid programs. Robert found that working with students on an individual level gave him the most reward. Seeing them graduate after meeting with them earlier in their college years gave him satisfaction that he is actually making a difference. Challenges Robert faces revolve around the rules and regulations of the government. In financial aid, you are working constantly around dates and deadlines. This being said, when the federal government pushes the FAFSA completion date back to December, how does the financial aid office have to change the way they work to accommodate these changes? Dealing with the expiration of the Perkins Loan Program on September 30th, 2017, left Robert and his staff with a large gap in providing students with this loan. A Perkins Loan, per the studentaid.gov site, is a low-interest loan for both undergraduate and graduate students. In this loan, your school is the loaner, and made with government funds. You would repay this loan to the school at a fixed rate of 5%. This loan was useful as a tool for the financial aid program because it would make up a small difference in funds for those who might really need it. Robert goes to say that the challenges in the financial aid office extends just beyond their area. To quote, "Financial aid is like an octopus. It has tentacles in pretty much everything. Financial funds have a hand in many programs an institution provides. With that, it is up to those in the FAP to distribute the funds they receive for programs, loans, and grants to students that need it at their institution." Interesting, right? I will get back to the rest of Robert Bodie's interview later in the episode as we talk about marginalized groups and the evolution of financial aid programs. You know, as I left that interview, I walked around the UWRF campus and asked students how they felt financial aid was distributed. Most assumed it was through the government, mainly through FAFSA. Not many students know where their money trail begins and where it ends up. I would always receive some sort of shrug and some, I don't knows. So, I offer a challenge to those who are curious before I get into the next subject. The challenge is for you to objectively research how many financial aid programs are open to anybody at your institutions. What can you find out about them, and would you be eligible? And more importantly, would you need help understanding their impact to your life? My ears are open for your responses. Hello again, and welcome back. My next interview was with a financial aid counselor from a four-year public institution. This person asked to remain anonymous, and to make this clear, I will refer to them with a gender-neutral name, Jamie. To provide some context, Jamie is new to their position at the university, but had worked with financial aid programs for 10 years. I asked them the same questions I asked Robert: rewards, challenges, and if they were shared across the student affairs fields. They responded very similarly to Robert when it came to rewards. As a financial aid counselor, Jamie said their reward is shedding light on the process for the first-year, first-gen college students and families who are new to financial aid programming. When I asked about challenges, there was one word Jamie could say for sure, and that was anxiety. Anxiety, especially anxiety over money, has changed over time. Other challenges Jamie pointed out was these radical changes that can happen when the federal government is attempting to streamline the process with new programs and regulations. It was a common theme across the board. When I talk to Robert, when I talk to Jamie, and when I talk to my next interviewee, I'll bring up Tim, that these rules and regulations seem to be changing at a faster, less predictable rate. And you could foresee things coming, but you wouldn't know if they were going to be put into effect. You didn't know what is going to be renewed, and I could see how that could have been a problem, especially looking at it through a student affairs lens, trying to be student-focused, and also trying to provide the best quality of programming that you can. So, in Jamie's eyes, it can be challenging to be a representative of these new laws and regulations that aren't very popular. Jamie, when asked about how these challenges are shared across other student affairs fields, said, "A little bit of knowledge can be quite dangerous." Jamie feels that sometimes other areas of student affairs are not keeping up with the changes of law, regulations, and policy in financial aid programs. This can pose a problem of disconnect with the best intentions, which could lead some areas of an institution giving misleading advice to students who might rely on financial aid. An issue with those who are not in full immersion with financial aid programs is the more simple the government tries to make financial aid, the more experience and immersion to the functional area is necessary. Jamie says with a push to a one-stop, one-system model, it could be detrimental to their institution because knowing the rules and regulations of a financial aid and billing department at the same time is a lot of work. And even today, all departments on a college campus do not have a complete and accurate knowledge of everything going on in areas that are different from theirs, and we wouldn't expect them to. Jamie says, "We don't expect the post office to do what the DMV does, and vice versa." That resonated with me. If we are not giving correct referral information out as student affairs professionals while constant changes are being made to the financial aid system, aren't we misleading students, therein creating more work for them and ourselves? This comes to question especially when talking about marginalized individuals, which is the point I will make coming up. How does financial aid affect those who are disadvantaged to the system, or those who may not have as much resources coming into the college experience? You know, talking with Tim, who we'll get to in the next clip, Robert, and Jamie, it feels like there's this constant influx of new stimulus and different ways to think about financial aid. I went to North Dakota State University, and that's where our next interviewee will be from. And their system of financial aid changed twice while I was there. I come to the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and I see their system as a more, not informal, but it is a smaller institution. So I can see how there are still the same moving parts, less personnel for less students. But at the same time, you're getting so much, and I can go and I can get an interview with the director of financial aid, and I think that's important. Welcome back. Before I was cut off by the lovely Anchor app, I was talking about being at different institutions and how that affected me personally. I went through two different financial aid experiences when I was at North Dakota State University as an undergrad. And while I came to UWRF, where the director, Robert Bodie, is, it seemed very different. And I understand that the programs could be the same or similar, but if I was a student going from one, transferring to one place to another, it would seem very daunting. It would seem very problematic. I don't know even if I'd want to tackle it. I, off of that thought, had posted something on Facebook earlier, and I asked on this page, on this Facebook page, called Millennials in Student Affairs, so these emerging professionals, just with one word, one to two words, of how they would describe their feelings when they heard the word financial aid programs. And from these people that have, you know, 3 to 5 to 8 years full-time in student affairs in the different fields I got a lot of good answers. 3 years in student affairs, headache, paperwork, policy, and their first word that they thought of was, just UGH. I'm getting graduate student responses that say, you know, it's confusing. You get hall directors that just, you know, say money, too many acronyms, confusing, overwhelming, insufficient, scary. My first word whenever I thought of financial aid programs was the word daunting. I personally did not understand it. I didn't want to take out money. I also didn't have the resources to not take out money or to not follow a program to get my own financial aid. But it felt like for me, I didn't need it. I could have worked out. I was raised to, you know, work. And if you don't have enough money, you shouldn't be paying for it. But that changed when it came to college. My parents actually actively told me to take out loans, and that was the strangest thing. The further down these comments, I'm seeing complicated, you know, I'm seeing opportunity, and interest rates. Those last three, that I read were by people with experience in financial aid. Opportunity was made by a financial aid coordinator for 2 years. And along with the one that said interest rates. I find these comments particularly useful because when I want to assess my peers, when I want to look at what's the terminology surrounding financial aid programs, this functional area, I could definitely go to directors and, you know, financial aid coordinators, and I could ask, what is your lens? What is your perception? And those that have been in the field will know what their lens is, but they might be oblivious to it. They might be so fully immersed that it's hard to see how the other side is, what barriers they might not be putting up intentionally. Now, I have no idea whether Robert Bodie, Jamie, or my next interviewee that is coming up have intentionally put up these barriers as administration officials. But if my peers feel this way when discussing financial aid programs, how could that feel for marginalized groups that come to institutions, these first gen, these international students, those with communication barriers, those with disabilities, how could they interpret these challenges? And that is the next question I'll pose, and I think I have a very good conversation with Timothy Alvarez, the current student affairs, vice president of student affairs at North Dakota State University. I traveled 4 hours to see him, and we had a great conversation. Stay tuned for the next clip. If you would like to get your voice heard on the air, or have any questions, you can comment on them here, and I'll post your question and my response on the air. I'd also love to hear from you, the listener, and thank you very much. Welcome back. Again, this is Student Affairs Brainstorming Session. My name is Logan Hermes, and we're going to continue talking about financial aid programs and marginalized groups with a third interview that I did with Dr. Timothy Alvarez. So marginalized groups, what does that mean? What does that mean to be in a marginalized group at a university, and how does that affect financial aid programs? Well, according to Centro de Educación Innovativa, Elizabeth Seton, or CEIES, in 1999, marginalized groups are a more, well, I guess a more well-known term, is that groups of people that face social exclusion. And that is defined as a combination of a lack of economic resources, social isolation, and limited access to social and civil rights. Marginalized groups face social exclusion by problems related to work, education, and living standards across the board. In financial aid programs, those in marginalized groups tend to need more help than those who may have access to more resources or do not have a language barrier. I asked all three of my interviewees about how financial aid programs affect this demographic. Dr. Timothy Alvarez current vice president of student affairs at North Dakota State University. I've known him for over 3 years now, and I respect his insight when it comes to the field. I traveled 4 hours to have some coffee and talk about financial aid programs, and what I gathered there was very important. Before I begin the interview with Tim, I would like to establish the various lenses we've currently seen. First, we had the Director of Financial Aid Programs, Robert, a financial aid counselor, Jamie. Both work at financial aid and have become immersed in their field, respectively. They shared similar answers to my questions through the interview, but when it came to Tim, I felt I could see another half of the argument I didn't even know existed, and it formed in my head. Tim and I sat down for coffee after a nice talk about how both of us had been holding up, and I asked him what I had discussed with the other two prior. You know, what are some rewards? What are some challenges you could experience while working with financial aid programs? Tim was very vocal about finding meaning in financial aid programs, and he asked, what are we trying to accomplish? That answer was school affordability. I had not really heard this before, but when you think about it, I guess it's true. I'm sure I could have figured it out on my own, but then Tim said something when asked about challenges. He said, we give aid to students who can afford to attend school the most. I did not understand that fully until we started talking about students' equality of opportunity and equality of the outcome of that opportunity. We expect that if we give each student the same format, they will equally excel. This, in part, was especially true for NDSU's financial aid process, as there was a one-stop, as we discussed with Jamie prior, a one-stop station that handled each student's financial aid needs. Even when I was interviewing Tim at the time, I tried to set up an interview with the financial aid counselor there, and it was difficult in order to get some of these names of these individuals that worked in the financial aid programs at NDSU because they didn't show up on the website, and I had to go through the one-stop station as a non-student and ask people I had no idea to meet with me for this project. I thought that was daunting, and I'm a graduate student. I'd been to that institution. Imagine going to this one-stop, one area for financial aid and billing as a first-generation college student or even a first-generation international student. Robert Bodie, in my interview with him, said one of the challenges he sees when dealing with people from marginalized groups is that there are a lot of barriers in the communication of students who come from disadvantaged backgrounds. Robert said the irony is that we deal with these students all the time, but there is still a trouble communicating constantly. Most don't know the difference between the word loan or grant, or maybe there's some misinformation between resources, as Jamie put it earlier. With an area that is constantly reinventing itself, I think the question we should be asking is how are we reinventing the process so that the most disadvantaged students can receive this aid as much as those who may have a leg up when it comes to comprehension. In the next clip is me talking with Tim Moore. Again, I actually don't have Tim in the next clip as per the rest of these interviews, but it's a specific topic about how marginalized groups may fare through financial aid process. And I really hope you stay tuned, because the points we bring up are incredibly interesting and might give you a different lens on how this works for those that aren't already set up to succeed. Stay tuned. Welcome back. To finish my interview with Tim, I specifically asked how financial aid programs impact marginalized groups that attend college. What I'd gathered from Timothy Alvarez is that at most research institutions, we give aid to merit-based students. By those policies and beliefs, Tim says we continue to marginalize first-gen, low-income, and international students. As these income gaps grow, institutions are more likely to confidently loan to students who have a better chance of paying off their debts. Those who also want to give grants and scholarships rarely look to the middle of this cluster or the low end of this income gap pyramid, especially when it comes to students. This part made sense to me as well. If you're not donating to any university's brick and mortar, you know, their buildings, you're definitely probably donating to student programs or individual students with scholarships. And if I had a lot of money and wanted to give a scholarship to students at my own institution, I would want to, you know, sponsor the best student possible in my interest area. That being said, if the system already sets those with the most resources come in to succeed and feel more secure financially. You know, whether it's not having to pick up a second job and get involved on campus, or not having to go home and take care of family every weekend, which is honorable, but these things that could detract from studies, from getting involved, from putting an extra bullet on that resume, you're setting that up as a disadvantaged student in comparison to those who have the time to fill up those scholarships and those grants. And that made a lot of sense. So, what could we do about it? I mean, for the students that could have succeeded without financial aid succeeded without financial aid programs, you know, they are at the top of the food chain. And what we're giving them is more success. Tim and I discussed how NDSU handles their financial aid and what can be done to help students who need an extra push financially to succeed, and what type of plans can be made for those individuals. Specifically, we talked about microgrants. What is a microgrant? Well, from Inside Higher Ed, we look at, you know, this article titled Small Grants, Big Impacts. And if you're ever curious about how one would help marginalized groups, this is a great idea. So Tim summarized it, and he said that it's basically a program where we make this deal with a certain set of students, about 30 or so, you know, depending on how much money you have to spare. And if they have 500 left before registering for the next semester classes, you know, or 1500 between a certain amount, you would help the student and come to an agreement that the institution would grant them this money if they fulfilled certain requirements. Or basically saying, hey, we enjoy your work, we enjoy your leadership here, we want to reward you for helping you stay in college. And I think that is important. Georgia State University has the best microgrant system in the nation, and it estimates it gets a 200% return on investment with its Panther Retention Grant Program. It was one of the largest and established completion-oriented microgrants offered by any university. So students can receive $100 up to $2,000 in order for them to continue just their education. That's pretty impressive. But what do you think? Especially, what do you think about marginalized populations? Before we digest too much, I want to hear from you about any questions you may have on how marginalized groups at your institution work with financial aid. No system is perfect, and later we'll talk about the growth involving FAP and how it relates to those CAS standards we talked about at the beginning of the episode. Stay tuned. Hello, and welcome back. First off, I'd like to thank you for listening. You made it this far. For the last segment, I will focus on the CAS standards and growth in the financial aid program area. As discussed prior, the CAS standard for financial aid programming is not supposed to be a perfect representation on how to perform in the functional area. However, it should set a good guideline. After speaking with Robert, Jamie, and Tim about the growth in financial aid programs, I received a mixed bag of responses. Robert spoke on how the area keeps reinventing itself, and currently the federal government is hoping for an easier federal aid form for students to use. He described the federal government like watching the 800-pound gorilla eat anything in the room. Sort of like switching to a one loan, one grant program, and how a two-question FAFSA could spur multiple different state forms and regulations onto adding more college forms per institution for each student to fill out instead of a one federal form as we see today with the FAFSA. Long, sometimes arduous, but switching and putting the other questions onto the states and the school with this two-question FAFSA, this one loan, one grant program, that could definitely be in our future. And I've never been a part of that, but I would enjoy, but also be wary to see how that turns out. Jamie described complications in the future with question marks on the Department of Education's focus and the uncertainty that they have been working with an ever-changing system. Who does the training for them? And are they consistent with new regulations? I felt when talking to Jamie about changes, it brought up kind of their own anxiety about how can they best perform for students at their level. You're given so much to work with growing up in a field, and I've never been in that position. Granted, I have never worked in something for 10 years, but I imagine just like technology, I grew up with the rise of technology. I mean, I still remember when phones were plugged into the wall, right? And now we're receiving and we're getting new things every year. Technological growth, in my perspective, I don't believe correlates with the change in regulations, rules, and policies of financial aid programs. But it gives you a different shock every time something new comes out and you have to learn how to cope with it. Tim believes that his current institution is slowly getting to a more student-focused financial aid program system. People are starting to give scholarships to those who are doing well instead of brick-and-mortar funding. This being said, when looking at the CAS standards for financial aid programs, there's a section that says financial aid programs must be intentionally designed, guided by theories and knowledge in learning and development, integrated into the life of the institution, reflective of developmental and demographic profiles of the student population, responsive to needs and individuals of population with distinct needs and relevant constituencies, delivered using multiple formats, strategies, and context, and designed to provide universal access. From these, I find some differences. Are campuses actually responsive to the needs of individuals with distinct needs? In Robert's case, I would assume so, but at NDSU, it would seem a one-size-fits-all solution is happening. Is financial aid being delivered using different formats, strategies, and contexts? Are all students at both institutions I've mentioned providing multiple ways to fill out forms and explain terminology to students who may not know or be inhibited with a language barrier? Lastly, are they supposed to be designed to provide universal access? And this is the point I will end on. Universal access to financial aid programs should encompass not only paying attention to their acute needs, but also their demographic needs as well. I used to see financial aid as a one-size-fits-all mentality, and I would see it as a one-stop shop for your loan and grant needs. In actuality, those like Robert and Jamie who serve students are only given so much information on how to focus on their students who need help. Tim sees another side of the spectrum with the students who may not receive enough help. Neither one party is wrong in their actions or words, but I do want to ask how they plan for improvement. Is the solution microgrants, or is it creating an easier-to-understand process? As a student affairs professional looking into financial aid programs, I believe these are the questions that should be asked. If you have any feedback, I'd be glad to hear it. I would like to thank you very much for tuning in, and have a wonderful day.